Translation in Purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation, Bali Maharaj, along with all the priest acharyas and members of the assembly, observed the Supreme Personality of Godhead's universal body, which was full of six opulences. That body contained everything within the universe, including all the gross material elements, the senses, the sense objects, the mind, intelligence and false ego, the various kinds of living entities, and the actions and reactions of the three modes of material nature. Purport. In Bhagavad Gita, the Supreme Personality of Godhead says, Aham sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartite. Krishna is the origin of everything. Vasudeva sarvam iti. Krishna is everything. Matstani sarvabhutani nachaham tveshravastitaha. Everything rests in the body of the Lord, yet the Lord is not everywhere. Mayavadi philosophers think that since the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth, has become everything, he has no separate existence. Their philosophy is called Advaitavada. Actually, however, their philosophy is not correct. Here, Bali Maharaj was the seer of the Personality of Godhead's universal body, and that body was that which was seen. Thus, there is Advaitavada. There are always two entities, the seer and the seen. The seer is a part of the whole, but he is not equal to the whole. The part of the whole, the seer, is also one with the whole, but since he is but a part, he cannot be the complete whole at any time. This achintya bhedabhira, simultaneous oneness and difference, is the perfect philosophy propounded by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So thank you all for giving me opportunity for my self-purification. Speaking in a new environment is always challenging because you lack relationship with the individuals in the audience. So it's easy to disturb the minds, perhaps with your particular mood or not understanding the particular mood of the environment. You can easily cause disturbance to the minds of the devotees in the environment. Or you can be ineffective just because you lack relationship. You don't know the relevant things to speak and so on. And therefore, speaking in a new environment is always a great challenge and quite scary. So I'm partially nervous, but because I'm confident devotees are merciful, then I think it can relieve me of my fear that if I do say something that's inappropriate or in contradistinction with the mood here, that you will be like a honeybee and just take the essence and forgive me for my transgressions. So thank you very much for having me and giving me the opportunity for my self-purification. So here, Vamana Deva is now showing the universal form to Bali Maharaj and others. So Prabhupada's purport opens up with saying that Krishna is the origin of everything, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo, and then Krishna is also everything, Vasudeva Sarvam Iti. So it's mentioning here that Krishna is the efficient cause and the material cause of everything. You know these terms, efficient cause and material cause? You've heard these terms. It comes up quite a bit in the Bhagavatam. Efficient cause, material cause. You've heard this before. So efficient cause refers to an agent who brings something into being. And a material cause means the substance on which that thing is made of. Does it make sense? Like, I'll give an example, like a clay pot. Then the efficient cause of the clay pot would be the person, the agent who brings the clay pot into being, right? He's called as the efficient cause, right? And then the material cause of the pot is the clay itself, right? So here we're hearing that Krishna, he's the origin of everything, so he's the efficient cause. And he is also the material cause. He is the substance of which everything is composed. So this creates somewhat of a contradiction. How can the efficient cause and the material cause be the same? Right? Of course, the materialists, they also think like this. They think matter is the efficient and material cause of everything, isn't it? Because they say that matter is the source of everything, and everything is also composed of matter, isn't it? This is the understanding of the general materialists. So for them, matter is God. And, of course, it's indicated by their complete Ananya Bhakt dedication to the material energy. Because God is the efficient and the material cause of or matter in the case of the materialist, is the efficient, the material cause of everything. Of course, as Vaishnavas, we don't accept this understanding of existence. What might be the reason we might reject this understanding that matter is the efficient cause? Why would we reject that idea that matter is the efficient cause? Yeah. Okay, matter can't sustain itself, right? Any other contributions? Why can't matter be the efficient cause? It can be convincing that matter is the material cause, because everything here is composed of material elements. So that's a little bit convincing. But why don't we accept that matter is the efficient cause, the source that brings everything into existence? Yeah. Because it's temporary? Okay, not quite, yeah. Exactly, because matter isn't conscious. The efficient cause refers to an agent who brings something into being. So the agent has to be conscious. So if matter is unconscious, how can it be an efficient cause of anything? Right? Does it make sense? So we don't reject this because matter doesn't have agency. So in order for, so the cause of the material universe has to be a supreme agent who has the power to bring a whole universe into being, because that's no small task. Bringing a whole universe into being. So that materialistic idea is kind of defeated there in the sense that at least matter can't be the efficient cause. But on our side, we say that Krishna is the efficient cause. That makes sense. But then he's the material cause as well. He's the substance of everything that we see. So that doesn't seem to make sense either. Okay, for the materialist side, their argument is, their standard is that the material causes matter. That makes sense, actually. But matter cannot be the efficient cause. So that doesn't make sense. In our side, God is the efficient cause. That makes more sense, just logically. But that God is also the material cause, how does that make sense? Does that make sense? That seems somewhat contradictory, huh? So then, Prabhupada is reconciling that understanding here by referring to the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Mastani sarvabhutani nachaham tveshravastitaha. You know these verses? How many of you got like Bhakti Shastri degrees in here? A few people. Bhakti Shastris. You know, so this verse comes from chapter 9 of the Bhagavad Gita. Mastani sarvabhutani. So everything is resting in Krishna. Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita. Everything is resting in me. So that means that Krishna, everything is dependent upon Krishna, right? Does it make sense? Everything's resting in Krishna means everything is dependent upon Krishna. Does it make sense? It's a simple point. And so this understanding tends to indicate Krishna's personal involvement, right? If something is dependent on us, then we have to become personally involved, isn't it? Sometimes we experience that. If something is dependent upon us, then we are personally involved in that something, isn't it? And then Krishna, after saying that, he says, Nachaham tvishavasitaha, but I am not depending on anything. Everything is dependent on me, but I am not resting anything, or I am not dependent upon anything, right? We also tend to sometimes think this due to the influence of some temporary psychosis that everything is depending upon me, and I'm not depending upon anything. Sometimes one thinks that, in delusion, one thinks that without me, how are things going nicely? Isn't it sometimes... You don't have that experience. No one has that experience of thinking like that. I'm the only one, the only conditioned soul in this room that thinks like that. Huh? Yes? Sometimes this is tangential, but I'll just bring it up anyway. I remember when I first joined the Brahmacharya Ashram in Chicago, I thought my enthusiasm was all powerful. My sincerity was exquisite and so on. You know, the regular sort of thinkings of the conditioned soul in the beginning. And so I had to leave Chicago. I left Chicago for a month to go to New Vrindavan to be with my spiritual master and so on. So when I left, I thought, how would things go on without me? You know, I'm the source of great inspiration. Things are depending upon me. I'm not depending upon anything. So I can just go because I'm not dependent upon anything. I was thinking in this way. And after 1 month, a devotee from Chicago came to pick me up. And so I got in the car and said, so how is everything in Chicago? From the vantage point of my psychosis of thinking things would be going down because I wasn't there. And then the devotee, he was a vice president. He said, "Oh, everything is fine." It was like you weren't even, we didn't even notice that you were gone. Oh, what a blow to the false. We didn't even notice I was gone. Everything is dependent upon me, you know. So this, of course, this is regular thinking of the conditioned soul. It is natural for conditioned souls to think like that. So when Krishna says everything is dependent on me and I'm not dependent on anything, then due to our projection of our material false ego into Krishna, we may get a little envious hearing Krishna say this. Therefore, in the beginning of this chapter 9, Krishna says the qualification for hearing this is you should be non-envious, right? What is that? How does that go? Bhakti Shastris? How does that first verse of Bhagavad Gita go? Not chapter 9? Anyone remembers? What's that? Anasuya, huh? Udam tu te guhyatama pravakshami anasuyave, right? Krishna says, I'm going to reveal to you this most confidential knowledge. Why? Because you're not envious of me. That means you're not going to be disturbed hearing me glorify myself. So then Krishna says this, everything is dependent upon me, and I am not dependent upon anything, right? This is actually true. So then in the very next verse, Krishna says, Nacha mastani bhutani, but at the same time, everything is not resting in me. Everything is not dependent upon me. So that's a direct, at least apparent contradiction, right? He just says everything is dependent upon him. And the next verse he said, but everything is not dependent upon me. Right? So this is a direct contradiction, isn't it? What are you saying, Krishna? It's double talk. At least if you kind of like spread out the contradictions throughout, we might miss it, you know? You said one thing in chapter 9 and a contradicting statement in chapter 12. So there's a good chance we might miss it because we're usually very inattentive in our hearing and study. But Krishna says it right after the next verse. Everything is dependent upon me, and everything is not dependent upon me. So then we can easily see, well, Krishna, you know, you're contradicting yourself here. Right? He makes it very clear that he's apparently contradicting himself. But this is not a contradiction. This is what's called a paradox. A paradox is something that appears like a contradiction in order to make us think. Because generally, when we hear, we oftentimes misunderstand things because the reference point of our hearing might be an assumption that's a misconception. Right? Does it make sense? Sometimes the speaker is speaking things, and we are operating with certain levels of assumptions, which may actually be misconceptions. So when the speaker says a particular thing, we understand it in a different way, right? And therefore, a Christian will say something paradoxical to shake up our misconceptions and make us think, wait a minute, it doesn't make any sense. So then we have to try to make sense of something that appears to not make sense. Does it make sense? Right? This happens all the time that you'll find that the most powerful, let's say, for example, the most powerful arguments that people make are usually the arguments that are never stated, but just the ones that are assumed, right? Just an example is recently in Chicago, one of our brahmacharis, one of our men there in Chicago, he joined with his girlfriend about a year ago. And she was very attached to him, so he became a devotee, she also became a devotee. And later on, he ended up joining the brahmachari ashram. And she also remained a devotee, but, you know, that was a little bit of a blow. And so she's still very attached to him. So she found a particular paper of a particular devotee who was in ISKCON for so many years and who ended up leaving ISKCON. And so he went through a long list of beliefs of the ISKCON community, which spoke of our beliefs very disparagingly. The presentation was to disparage our way of thinking. And so he said things like, they think sex is bad, they think family life is bad. In essence, he just started going down a list of certain things that we think, and which seem obviously very bad. Like, to say sex is bad is obviously insane, right? To say family life is, you know, how we mentioned family life is a prison, andukupam. This is obviously crazy, right? So then he kind of presented this long list of things that we think, which seem obviously crazy. So this devotee in Chicago mailed me and asked me, how should I understand this? Because I'm a little bewildered. And I said, well, he's speaking of our beliefs very disparagingly, and that's fair. Everyone's got their let's say, perspective. But what he doesn't do is talk about those things philosophically. He just says they think like this. And what it means is that he's already addressing a set prejudice. The set prejudice is that sex is good, family life is good. And therefore, all he has to say is they think that this is bad. He doesn't ask the audience to examine it philosophically. It's just like if we were to say, you know, in Islam, they make their women cover from head to toe. Now, in a Western culture in America, or probably I'll bet here also in London, when the dress code is a little bit different, obviously, if you say they make women dress from head to toe, that obviously just seems bad and oppressive automatically without even having to say it, right? Does it make sense? It is just assumed that that is bad and it's never actually examined, right? So when we think that, you know, attachment to the temporary is not very healthy. And so he says they think in this way without asking the audience to examine what it is that we're actually, what's our stance, or to examine their own stance on a particular issue philosophically. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? My point is that so the strongest arguments are usually the ones that are never stated. They're just assumed, right? So also, similarly, the strongest misunderstandings are often based on our assumptions of things without having actually examined the conception very deeply, right? We hear something like, for example, God is a person. And we assume that personhood means persons like what we see on this earth. So when the speaker says God is a person, based on the assumption that personhood means something of this material realm, they misunderstand what we mean by God as a person. So then you'll have statements in the Shastras that say God is a person, he's also not a person. Just to make you think about that, to slow down and actually examine your conceptions, right? Does this make sense what I'm saying? Because oftentimes we don't do enough examination of our own conceptions. We just assume that we're heading in the right direction. And so the Shastras, if you read them carefully, they present stumbling blocks to those things to force us to examine our actual conceptions and thus improve them. Because conception is the basis for all movement in this world, right? Although conceptions are static and application is dynamic, right? Static means conceptions don't move. Has anyone ever seen a conception move? Our conceptions don't move, but they're the basis for all the movement that we're doing in this world, right? All the dynamic movement we do are based on certain sets of conceptions, right? I have the conception that I'm this body. So based on that conception, I conduct my life, right? Does this make sense what I'm saying? So therefore, Shastra has to present stumbling blocks in our ordinary way of thinking in order to make us examine our conceptions so that our movement can become more dynamic towards the absolute. Otherwise, as long as there's some misconceptions means energy misapplied in the wrong direction. Have you, any of you ever, well, some of you have specs here. I used to wear glasses when I was younger because I thought I looked nice with glasses. I didn't actually require them, but I had this experience of, I know for those of you with specs, for example, I had this experience of sometimes where you put the glasses, or maybe sunglasses we may have all worn at one time, and you put the sunglasses on top of your head, and you become so used to the feeling that you forget that they're actually there, right? And so then you start looking for your glasses, and you say, I know I put it right here on the table, Prabhu, where did you move it, you know? Because I see you're cleaning up the ashram, where did you move my glasses? And you're like so convinced that your glasses were there, so that one misconception keeps all your energy looking in the wrong spot. You know, and then that Prabhu says, Prabhu, on top of your head, you know, oh, okay, thanks, you know? You don't say sorry or anything, you just say Hare Krishna, and you walk away. So the point is that when we have misconceptions, our energy can be misengaged or misdirected, right? I think the temple is west, but that temple is actually east. But that one misconception keeps my energy full speed ahead in the western direction. So Shastras also have to speak in such a way that force us to adjust our conceptions. Because as long as our conceptions are not perfectly clear, then our movement towards the absolute will be actually encumbered. Does this make sense? So oftentimes we want to know, how do we improve our Krishna consciousness, right? How do I improve my japa? In America, they were doing these japa retreats that cost like $500 because they was like in some real fancy space in the woods. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not disparaging that at all. But $500 is not a joke, you know, especially for many devotees, because most devotees aren't like, you know, the richest, how you would say in London, the richest lads on the block. So then $500 is a quite a significant amount of money. So therefore, devotees would spend $500 because they want to improve their japa. That makes perfect sense from a spiritual perspective. I want to improve my connection with Krishna. So $500. What is $500 to improve my connection with Krishna, right? So they would spend this money. I don't think they're doing these retreats now, probably because it's $500 and unless people were able to actually afford it. But there's an easier way of actually improving our japa and our movement towards Krishna. We just need to improve our conceptions, because it's the conceptions that actually make our movement towards the absolute encumbered. So just by getting clearer and clearer ideas of what Krishna is actually saying in the shastras, all your movement towards the absolute will be deepened, your japa and everything else that goes along with it. And therefore, our program is a very simple program for actually improving everything. You hear and then you apply. You hear and you apply. And the hearing is supposed to be removing misconceptions. So as misconceptions are getting removed, then your application becomes deep. It's a very simple process, but oftentimes due to its simplicity, it's hard to appreciate the depth of its of the meaning of that process. Does this make sense? So back to, it's not too unclear, right? Okay. So then, now back to what Krishna says. So everything is dependent upon me. At the same time, everything is not dependent upon me. So he's forcing us to examine our conception of what dependence means. Because when Krishna says everything is dependent upon me, that implies his personal involvement. But then by saying that everything is not dependent upon me, that means he's not actually personally involved. This is what he wants us to understand. Pashame yogam aishranam. Understand my yoga aishranam, my mystic opulence, right? This is what Krishna says in that verse. What is this yoga aishranam? Understand my yoga aishranam is that everything is dependent upon me. At the same time, everything is not dependent upon me. Understand my mystic opulence. So what is this yoga aishranam? Bhakti Shastris. How many people here did the Bhakti Shastri degree? Right, and got really good grades? So Bhakti Shastris. What is the yoga aishranam that Krishna speaks about in this verse? Pashyame yogam aishranam. Understand. Pashyame means understand or see. Understand my yoga aishranam, my mystic opulence. So he's trying to resolve the contradiction for us now and help us examine what it means for Krishna to be a person. Anyone knows? You know, probably don't remember, huh? Yoga aishranam. Did you ever go back to the Bhagavad Gita after passing the test? Yeah, they cram, and then after they finish, okay, Bhagavad Gita as it is on the shelf for the next 20 years. Pashyame yogam aishranam. What does Krishna mean? Yeah, anyone remembers? Yes, actually refers to his swarup, which is filled with inconceivable potency. If you go and read Prabhupada's purport, that's exactly what he talks about. His yoga aishranam refers to his swarup, Krishna's swarup, which is filled with inconceivable potencies, right? So when Krishna says everything is not dependent upon me, Krishna means it's not that I have to struggle to maintain the universe, right? When we have to, when like managing a temple, for example, many of us may not be managers. And for me, I think that's a great benediction. Because to be a manager is obviously, probably, I would assume, is somewhat miserable. Although in class it may say it's very blissful seva, but I think experientially it might be quite a bit of a challenge. So they have to manage something very difficult. It's very challenging, and a lot of labor is involved in order to do that. So Krishna's saying, when he says everything is not dependent upon me, he's saying you should not think that I have to struggle to bring about a universe and maintain it. That's his point. And so if you read the purport, Prabhupada gives the example of Atlas holding up a globe, right? Why does Prabhupada give that example? Because this is the idea that we'll get if Krishna is personally involved and have to maintain it. Oh, it must be very difficult to maintain a universe. No, so Prabhupada says Krishna is not like Atlas. You know Atlas? What is this, Greek mythology? Holding up the globe, and he's got like really huge muscles, and he's struggling to hold up the Earth planet. I think that was actually a punishment for Atlas, right? And does anyone know? Anyone remembers? I don't remember. I used to like Greek mythology, Hercules, Xena, these TV shows and so on. Anyway, I think actually that was a punishment for Atlas, right? Holding up the globe was a punishment. So we shouldn't think that everything is dependent upon God like that. Like he has to struggle to maintain a universe, to bring about a universe and maintain it. He doesn't have to struggle. So Krishna's saying, Pashame Yogam Aishram. All of these things are actually accomplished by my Achintya Shakti, which is endowed in my Swarup. Right? A very sweet example of this would be in Krishna Lila. When Mother Jasoda is trying to bind Krishna, right? When Mother Jasoda is trying to bind Krishna, Krishna doesn't have to like fight with her. You know, don't bind me. He's not fighting with Mother Jasoda. By one of his Shaktis, she's unable to bind him, right? If you read the commentary of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur on that pastime, which is very sweet. Mother Jasoda is struggling very hard to bind Krishna, but she always finds that the rope is 2 fingers too short. Right, so she calls all of her Gopika companions and okay, bring some rope. So the rope is like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet long, and still somehow other the rope is the width of 2 fingers too short. So how is that happening? How is it that she's not able to bind Krishna's Swarup? The reason is because in Krishna's Swarup there's an inconceivable Shakti called Satya Sankalpa Shakti. Satya Sankalpa Shakti. Whatever Krishna wants immediately becomes true. So he didn't want to be bound. So that's for that Satya Sankalpa Shakti was not allowing Mother Jasoda to bind Krishna, right? This is getting that point? Does it make sense? So then as she continues to struggle to bind Krishna, then what happens? What happens in the pastime? Very simple. She finally was able to bind Krishna. So how is it that she was able to bind Krishna all of a sudden when she was not able to do it before? So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that in the competition between Krishna and his devotee, the devotee always wins. So the devotee is called Bhakti Nisha. The devotee's great determination caused another Shakti in Krishna's Swarup to manifest. Which Shakti was that? The Kripa Shakti, Krishna's mercy potency. Seeing the determination of the Jasoda, the Kripa Shakti, which is also a part of Krishna's Swarup, manifested. And that mercy Shakti allowed Mother Jasoda to bind Krishna. Does it make sense? This is like slightly inconceivable, or actually completely inconceivable, because it's, you know, his Shaktis are doing everything for Krishna. He doesn't have to do anything. That's the point. So similarly, when Krishna brings about a universe and maintain it, he does it through his Shaktis, which are part of his Swarup. So this is the meaning of Pashame Yogam Aishwaram. Does this make sense so far? Okay, so then what does Krishna say after that? Bhuta brenna cha bhuta sto. So although I am maintaining the universe, I'm not in the universe. I'm aloof from it. Mama atma bhuta bhavana. Because by my, mama atma means by my mind, just by my willing it, I can maintain, manifest and maintain everything. So I'm not personally involved. I'm aloof. My swarup is actually aloof. And my shaktis, which are also not different from me, they do everything. Right? Does this make sense? So then in this way, Krishna wants us to examine the nature of his personhood. And it becomes very unique because then in the next verse, Krishna says, Yata kasho sito nityam vayu savacha go mahan. Tata sarvani bhutani matstani iti upadharya. Iti upadharya means try to understand. Iti upadharya, try to understand. He gives an analogy. Anyone remembers the analogy? Bhakti Shastris. Remember the analogies? The sky and the air, right? So he makes this analogy that just like everything is situated in space, or you can say dependent upon space, just like now, we're all dependent upon the space in this room to do our activities, right? Jai Shushyadako Kulananda Ki Jai. Right? We're all depending on the space in this room to conduct our activities. Not only us, but so many living entities are taking advantage of the space in this room to conduct their activities, isn't it? So we're depending upon space to do things, right? And yet space is not affected by the activities going on, nor is it interested in the activities going on, right? The ether in this room is not affected by what we're doing, nor is the ether care what we're doing also, right? You never have to apologize to the ether, right? I'm sorry for dancing roughly in your space, right? Of course, this is not extraordinary because ether is unconscious. But it is extraordinary with Krishna because Krishna is conscious. And yet he's not impacted by what we're doing, nor is he concerned about what we're doing also. Although he's the basis by which we're able to do anything at all. Right? So this analogy Krishna's given is very fitting in terms of his relationship to the material nature. Right? Is this making sense? So Krishna, this is the important point about this, which I'm getting to, and I'll close up my little discussion here. The important point that Krishna is having us examine about his personality is that in regards to material activities, he's completely aloof because everything can be taken care of by his shaktis. He doesn't have to be personally involved, right? So we'll from this point, we understand that Krishna's aloofness from us actually forces us to become the center of Krishna's consciousness because he's totally aloof from us. This is maybe a mundane example that might be fitting. It's like if a boy is attracted to a girl, right? Or vice versa. And the person they're attracted to is very popular, right? So due to their popularity, they're completely unaware of that individual, right? Who's attracted. They're totally aloof from that individual. Does it make sense? So similarly, Krishna's also very popular in his Braja Leela. So he's preoccupied with the Leelas in Braja, right? So he's completely aloof from the affairs of this world. He's not really conscious of us, so to speak. He's directly and indirectly conscious. We say like this, right? As Paramatma, he is directly conscious. But as Krishna, he's more unconscious of us. Or you can say he's indirectly conscious of us through Paramatma. Right? Does it make sense? Paramatma is more directly aware of what we're doing in the material world. And he's also aloof. He's just like a witness. And Krishna is unconscious of us because he's a little preoccupied with the gopis and the gopas in Braja. So he's unconscious of us, or he's indirectly conscious of us through the Paramatma, who's his personal expansion. So he doesn't have to be personally involved with us, right? So because Krishna is so aloof, the important aspect of this philosophical understanding about Krishna's Swarup is that because he's so aloof from us, we are forced to actually become a part of the center of Krishna's consciousness. When we have the idea that God is so conscious of us, we can remain the center of our own consciousness, isn't it? Because God is actually conscious of us. And so we can, in that understanding, we might remain very the center of our own consciousness. And when we find out Krishna's really kind of unconscious of us, and we want Krishna to be conscious of us, then that forces us to become the center of Krishna's consciousness. And it also forces us to remove ourselves out of the center of our own consciousness. Because we really want to get Krishna's attention, right? So proportionate the degree of intensity that we have to get Krishna's attention, to that degree, we are forced to remove ourselves from the center of our own consciousness, right? Does this make sense? In other words, we have to become Krishna conscious. Because only something very extraordinary can get Krishna's attention. What is that something that's very extraordinary that can get Krishna's attention? Devotion to Krishna, right? Bhakti, pure bhakti. That's the only thing that can actually capture his attention. So with Krishna being so aloof, it forces us to develop bhakti, pure bhakti. And that happens to be the theme of the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, pure bhakti. So Krishna kind of in an indirect way through these verses is encouraging us to develop pure bhakti, by which his aloofness can be subverted and he becomes attentive to us by such development, right? Does it make sense? So then what we're hearing about here is that how Krishna, we're hearing about Vamanadeva, everything's being a part of his Swarup. But so Prabhupada's taking the time to point our attention to the Bhagavad Gita that yes, everything is part of his Swarup and everything's being manifested by the energies which are intrinsic to his Swarup. But in order to personally associate with Krishna in his Swarup, then you have to develop bhakti, right? Therefore, it is mentioned by Rupa Goswami that Krishna Swarup and Krishna Nam are the same, right? What is that verse? Abhinatvam Namanami Na. How is that verse? Naman Chintamani Krishnas Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha Purna Shuddha Nityamukta Abhinatvam Namanami. Right? So what does that mean? The name and the named are the same, right? So Krishna Swarup and Krishna Nam is the same. But of the two, Krishna Nam is considered more merciful. Although they're the same, if there's any difference, Rupa Goswami says, if there's any difference, then the difference is that the name is more merciful than the Swarup of Krishna. Why is that? It may be obvious, but just to make sure everyone is still conscious of me. Why is the name of Krishna more merciful than the Swarup of Krishna? Yeah, it might be obvious, huh? Anyone can chant. Krishna, in order to actually get the association of Krishna's Swarup, you have to have exquisite bhakti. Otherwise, he's not really caring about us at all, in a sense. Or he's caring about us indirectly through the Paramatma, right? But if you really want to get Krishna's Swarup, the association of his Swarup, which would be pretty awesome, then you need exquisite bhakti, right? Which many of us may not possess yet. At least I can say I don't possess it. And so not possessing it, we're not able to associate with Krishna's swarup. But Krishna Nam is such that it is also Krishna, but it is more merciful than Krishna, because it will help us to develop exquisite bhakti by which we can get the association of Krishna's swarup, right? So then this kind of understanding we're getting. Vamanadeva, in terms of his swarup, has come before Bali Maharaj. Why? Because Bali Maharaj does have exquisite bhakti. And now, in order to show mercy to the living entities in this world, Krishna is showing his other opulences by which we can understand his personhood. So this is kind of the understandings that I was able to glean from my study of this particular purport. Krishna is spread everywhere through his energies, but simultaneously he is also a person. So Prabhupada points us out to this Achintya Bheda Bheda philosophy. So that's my discussion. I'm kind of like a dry philosopher. I just like dryness. I don't know why. Even when I eat prasadam, it should be dry most of the time. Everything should be dry. So if you found my discussion a little dry, I apologize for that. But I also like to speak in such a way that, as you see, I try to stick to the purport. I don't try to bring up other points that's not in the purport so much and so on. I just stick to those particular elements. And I think that's also safe because I don't know anyone here too well. So anyone wants to ask anything or inquire or contribute to the discussion a little bit?